This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your solo co-host this week, Ethan Frisch. And my guest is a new member of the Heritage Radio Network family with a brand new show launching very soon. Peter Reinhart is chef on assignment at Johnson & Wales University in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the author of many books and an all-around expert on all things baking and pizza. Peter, thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Likewise. Let's start with your new Heritage Radio Network show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that story? How did you come to start the show? And when, I guess we don't know exactly when it'll be available, but any day now,
I'm told.
Any day now. Right. Exactly.
So yes, stay tuned for alerts. But this series is a spinoff of a interview series I've been doing on my own website called pizzaquest.com. Which has for years has been sort of chronicling my never-ending search for the perfect pizza. And we've been doing it with videos and with interviews and with recipes and all sorts of, you know, ways of tracking this sort of journey. I call it a journey of self-discovery through pizza. And for the first number of years, we built it mainly around videos that my team made. We went out on the road and, you know, interviewed some of the great pizza makers in America. And again, trying to dig in a little bit into their gut to find out what it is that burns in their belly that drives them to the level of greatness that they've achieved to kind of break from the pack, from the standard everyday pizza guys to the people who are the go-to pizza makers. And we also follow folks that are artisans. So it's not just pizza makers, but anyone in the artisan community that's doing something extraordinary at that highest level. So that sort of spun off last year when we went into this year of the COVID. We couldn't go on the road and film. So I decided to follow up by doing Zoom interviews with a lot of the people that we haven't been able to get to with our cameras. And we would do like 45-minute to 60-minute interviews with dozens and dozens of these pizza luminaries. And after a while, we had quite a few in the can. We ran them as video shows. And started talking with Heritage Radio about repurposing these into audio podcasts, and because they were very, very verbal. It wasn't so much about making the pizzas. There wasn't a lot of demos, although we do have some of those. But it was really about, you know, the stories of these artisans. And so we found that they played well as podcasts. So we re-edited them and prepared to launch the first season of some of. We're going to start with 15 of the best of the interviews, and if everyone likes them, we've got more in the can, and we're continuing to make new ones every week.
That's really exciting. I mean, it sounds like a delicious and fascinating series of conversations. Can I ask kind of an inappropriate question? is there such a thing as the perfect pizza?
Well, it's funny because, you know, one of the great pizza makers we interviewed was a guy named Chris Bianco, who a lot of people know as sort of the poster boy of the artisan pizza movement. A pizzeria in Phoenix, Arizona, kind of raised the bar of what a pizza could be. And when I asked him that, you know, has he ever made a perfect pizza? You know, his answer was, making the perfect pizza is kind of like hitting the perfect golf shot. It's there, but it's always just out of reach. And if you do one and you think it's the best you ever made, then you have to, the very next day, try to top yourself. So it's sort of this, it's kind of one of those things that you reach for it, and as soon as you touch it, it kind of disappears in your midst. But my idea of what a perfect pizza is, and I kind of defined this in one of my earlier books called American Pie, My Search for the Perfect Pizza, is I kind of had to zero in on what do I mean by great, or what, because I really want to talk about what distinguishes good from great. And so what is great? And I decided that when it comes to pizza, what determines greatness is it memorable? That's the question asked. Is it so memorable that you can't get it out of your head, that it is embedded itself in your taste memory hall of fame, and you can't wait to bring your friends there, your family there. You just can't wait to get back to that place. And there's only a few places in any category, whether it's, you know, pizza or food in general or life and things that are important to us, that kind of reaches that pinnacle. And so that's sort of what I'm striving for. And then the question is, okay, so what makes it great? What causes it to break from the pack? What are they doing that the other people that are using flour, water, salt, yeast, and cheese and sauce, what, they're all using the same ingredients. How come some do it better than others? And that's the exploration that we're on.
And I guess pizza is sort of, I mean, as you just mentioned, kind of a deceptively simple process and subject. So what are some of the differences that can be expressed in just changing that handful of ingredients?
Yeah, and that's the key. And so in breaking it down, and you kind of have to kind of walk it back. The first thing that I, you know, kind of come up with a few axioms, and one of them is that a great pizza always starts with a great crust. You can't have a memorable pizza without a fabulous or memorable crust. In fact, some of the people that I've interviewed say that for them, a pizza is 80 to 90% about the crust and only 10 to 20% about the toppings. And of course, that's a debatable, you know, topic that you could, you know, get around a cup of espresso and talk about all night. But universally, I'd say most people agree that it really begins with the crust. And as a bread guy, because most of my books are really about bread making, you know, that rings true for me. I've always felt that about pizza. When I've had a pizza that for instance, we use the Pizzeria Bianco pizza as, again, the example, since he's started this whole sort of national craze about artisan pizza. The first time you take a bite of that pizza, there's something that happens. There's a sound that the crust makes. There's almost like a crackle factor. The undercrust has this snap and a shattering effect. The edge of the pizza, the carnicione, when you bite into it, it's both firm but yet creamy, and almost like the best ciabatta bread that you've ever had. And so all these factors come together, and then when you have really good ingredients on top, and we'll just say even just tomato sauce, because a marinara pizza is just sauce. That's all you need. In fact, you could just have olive oil on top. It's already so satisfying that you can't wait to take another bite or to come back again and have it over and over again. So that's the key. So then diving deeper into that, it's how do you make a crust that good? What is it that differentiates between the everyday pizza, which is, and again, all pizza is good. That's another rule of the game, is that there are only two kinds of pizza. There's good and there's very good. And by very good, I mean memorable. And so if 98% of the pizzas are good and 2% of the pizzas are very good and memorable, you know, what is it that they're doing differently? And then we're finding, of course, that since I kind of came up with that corollary, a lot more pizzerias have been learning from each other, and they've been adapting and adopting these principles of great bread making, great dough making. And so now it's not just 2%, it may be 10%. You know, the number of great memorable pizzerias is growing exponentially over the last few years, and a very large community of sort of the pizza making community has expanded, and everybody's very generously sharing with each other their tricks and tips. Very few people kind of hide their secret methods. And on the show, you know, they all share some of their particular tips. But Chris Bianco, again, when I asked him for some of his tips, his answer was quite interesting. He said, I could share my tips and tricks, and every pizza maker has them with others, but I think it would be a disservice. He said, as if to say that these tips and tricks are what make a great pizza. He said, that's not what makes my pizzas great. And of course, he'll argue with him, because he's a very humble guy. He'll argue and say, I'm not saying my pizzas are the best, but what makes my pizzas so good is not the fact that I make the dough by hand. I even pull my own cheese, and I have the tomatoes grown especially for me. And he lists all these things that he does that already are difference makers. But he said, but that's not what makes them so special. He says, what makes them so special is that I'm the one who's making them. And that was one of the things we found at the heart and soul of this journey, is that at every place where there was a memorable pizza, there was a person who cared. Because Chris's final comment was, I can teach people my tips, my tricks, but I can't teach them to care as much as I care. And that's what we really found, is that it takes a person who cares and really wants their work, this being their artistic expression, to really be great and to connect and to and to essentially, you know, when I asked him what his goal is when he feeds somebody, you know, his pizzas, what does he want them to experience? His answer was, I want them to experience my soul. And that was about the most profound thing I'd ever heard, whether from a pizza maker or anyone. And it rang true for me. And I think that's what drives the great artisans, is that they want people to, you know, to experience a little bit of their own soul when they experience the products that they make. And that's what opened up this whole, I mean, this was 15, 20 years ago when I interviewed Chris the first time, and it spun off into this 10-year project called Pizza Quest. And there's never ending array of new great players in the game who we keep talking to and interviewing that in their own way say things that are very similar to what Chris discovered in his own journey.
Do you find that aesthetic or that philosophy has changed over the couple of decades that you've been studying pizza and pizza makers?
I think that it's always been there at its heart and soul. You know, like, for instance, if you were to go to some of the great Naples pizzerias and that are still part of a family tradition, you'll see that sense of caring. If you go to a place like Frank Pepe's in New Haven, Connecticut, one of the great American pizzerias for the last 90 years, there are still people there that are part of the original family that drive this sense of, it's almost like a sense of mission that they have, that they want their pizzas to be so deeply satisfying for people that they just care and they hire people, even though they can't do them all themselves like Chris Bianco was doing. They hire people who are driven and buy into that same drive that they have to deliver a memorable product. So that aspect has grown because, you know, 99% of the pizzerias are just pizza places. It doesn't take great craft and skill to make a pizza. Anybody can learn how to make it. You can hire a high school kid to do it. But to take it to that next level, it does. It does take a sense of caring, and you kind of almost have to take it personal, you know, that when you're making something, you're creating an expression out of your own soul, even if it's a simple thing as a pizza. And we saw it first happen in the bread baking community when the artisan bread community kind of exploded on the scene in the 1990s. It was driven by that same kind of ethic. A lot of people who stumbled into bread making, like myself, where, you know, we're not trained at bread baking academies like they are in France, but who just fell in love with the process, began to learn from the bread masters, that many of whom we brought over from Europe to teach us their techniques and the method and the science. But we had adopted those principles with a kind of a zeal and a drive that even impressed the French. It even impressed, you know, the Europeans who've been making bread for hundreds of years, because they saw a kind of a renewed zeal here that then inspired even a renaissance in France in their own bread baking, where they'd gotten kind of a little bit, I hate to use the word stale, but, you know, they'd gotten a little stale and taken for granted their craft. So there was a big rejuvenation, and I'll call it a renaissance of bread making in the 90s and the first part of this, you know, the 2000s, that exploded out there. And then that carried over into the pizza community. And there's a great, great sort of overlap now in the bread baking community and the pizza community. And now a lot of pizzerias are making their own bread, and a lot of bakeries are making their own pizzas, because really, you know, pizza is just dough with something on it. So they're really just, you know, spinoffs of each other. And it's nice to see that again, all of this sharing of knowledge and application of that knowledge is taking place.
And I guess while we're on this topic, why don't you tell me a little bit about your origin story? How did you get into bread and into food in general? And what were you doing before?
Yeah, well, when I was in college, I was a film and broadcasting major at Boston University. And I, you know, really had a dream to be able to write. I wanted to write and direct films. And it was, you know, I was having a good experience and I felt like I had the talent to do it. But at somewhere during the college years, of course, everyone goes through kind of an identity crisis of like, what am I doing here? And, you know, what am I supposed to be doing with my life? And I realized that even though I may have some of the skills to be able to make films, I really didn't know what I had to say. I didn't know who I was, you know, what my sense of purpose in life was and what I was going to be writing about. And so I decided to step away from it for a while and kind of go on a what I call a journey of self-discovery. And I, you know, like a lot of people back, and this is, we're talking about like 1969, 1970, the Woodstock era, you know, I went on a spiritual quest and I started studying religions of the world. I started meditating, I did yoga, I started looking everywhere to the people who might have the answers to what is the purpose and meaning of life. And it led me on a very interesting journey. And the first thing that I kind of stumbled into was a group of people who were like myself, I'll call them sort of seekers, who were also looking for what they were supposed to do next. And we all had a common interest that we liked food. And a couple of people had the talent of being able to cook. So we opened a vegetarian organic restaurant in 1971 in Boston called Route One Cafe. It was spelled R-O-O-T, Route One Cafe, right on the bridge connecting Boston and Cambridge. And for the next 3 years, I learned and taught myself how to cook and got into food and got into a little bit of bread making, mostly making things like banana breads. I really didn't know much about bread making, but we bought our bread from another kind of hippie group that was doing natural sourdough whole grain breads. So we bought our breads from them, and I would watch them sometimes make their breads, and I got a little bit of a fascination for that. And then a few years later, my own journey kind of moved on, and I was looking for the next step for me, and I ended up taking a turn that I wasn't expecting. I found myself drawn to a group of Christians who were expressing their Christianity in a way unlike anything I had ever heard before. It was not evangelical. It was not conventional. It was kind of a blend of Eastern and Western religion. And it was a group called the Holy Order of Mans, M-A-N-S. And that M-A-N-S is an acronym for four Greek words that represent the strivings of the members. And I studied with them. I went to some of their classes. I found it really fascinating. It was kind of getting close to scratching the itch that I had about, you know, who I am and what I'm supposed to be doing. And after about a year or so of just kind of hanging on the edges of that, I just decided to go all in. And I ended up joining that community. And from 1974 on, I became known as Brother Peter in an order that was looked from on the outside kind of like a Jesuit, Catholic group. But it wasn't Catholic. It was actually non-denominational, non-sectarian. It wasn't affiliated with any church. But we had the garb of the clergy because we went and did a lot of service work. The model of the organization was service, that the fastest way to know God and to find your own purpose was to serve the God in other people. And that drew me, that spoke to me. And so I joined and intended at that point to essentially, you know, dedicate my life to this work of service, not knowing where it would lead. My father asked me, what about your ambitions to, you know, write and make movies and things? And I said, Dad, I'm just going to have to put it on the shelf for now. If it's meant to be, it'll come around at some time. But I right now I have to let go of that because I have to do what's right in front of me. And what's speaking to me right now is to follow this path. And
did you, was there a sort of an explicit connection between cooking or baking and the spiritual?
Well, that's where it gets interesting because I did have, because of my background at the restaurant for the last 3 years where I'd become a pretty good cook. They always, in seminaries, they always need cooks, you know. So I very often found myself in the kitchen itself. Now, the connections themselves sort of between food and spirituality, that sort of is up to each person to kind of articulate. And I have had a chance to do that later on. But first, they were able to use my skills, you know, in-house and at the various study houses and seminaries where we would do training. I would find myself often in the kitchen, sometimes as the full-time, you know, cook, where I'd be feeding 30 other seminarians every day, and other times where I would be on other projects, but I would, you know, when they needed somebody to step in on a weekend or something, I would always end up in the kitchen. I loved cooking, and I found myself loving it. And I ended up in San Francisco, where our headquarters was, at the main seminary. And while I was there, of course, San Francisco, and we're talking about sometime around 1978 to 1980, I was in the bread center of the United States. San Francisco at that point was the one place where you could count on getting good bread. And we all fell in love with the sourdough breads of San Francisco. And eventually a friend of mine, who was also a member of our community and liked baking bread, made some French bread following the specific directions of Julia Child in one of her books, like six pages of hard to follow directions. And he followed it and made some baguettes that blew everybody's minds. It was kind of like that moment of, you know, that we were talking about the difference between good and great. There's bread, and then there was this bread. And this bread was like a conversation-stopping bite of bread. And so I asked him how he did it. He told me where he had got the recipe. He said, if you're going to make it, just follow your instructions, you know, exactly. So I did. And I was the cook at the seminary. And so one night I made this French bread for 30, 35 people and put it out on the table that night. And after the dinner, everybody from the dining room came into the kitchen and they said, how did you make that bread? You've got to make it every night. That was the best bread we ever had. And so all of a sudden I was like, you know, I was hooked. And the next night I made it again, only being a rookie, I made a big mistake. I overproofed the bread. I over-fermented it and the bread rose too much. And by the time I went to put it in the oven, it had collapsed. It had fallen. And so what am I going to do? It's almost dinner time. I went ahead and scored it. I put the cut marks in it. I put it in the oven, baked it anyway. It came out with all these wrinkles on top and everything else. It was the ugliest bread you ever saw. But I sliced it up, put it in the bread baskets, and nobody could tell that it wasn't supposed to be that way because that it was sliced. And after dinner, they came back in the kitchen and they said, tonight's bread was even better than last night's. And I went, okay, here's my first principle of bread making is bread is always a hit, no matter how it turns out, if it's fresh. And so from that point on, I was just sort of hooked on bread making. And over the years, as I got deeper into my own studies and moved up to one of our other headquarters where we have a retreat center, I started doing other projects, a lot of them built around food because I still loved food. Eventually, I developed a multigrain bread called Struan, which was a harvest bread associated with the Michaelmas harvest festival. And it took me a few years to kind of perfect it. But when I did, by the time I did, I had gotten married. I found my wife, and she was a member of the community as well. She also liked to cook. We opened a little cafe together called Brother Juniper's Cafe in Forestville, California, in Sonoma County. And the whole purpose of that place was to just provide jobs for local high school kids and things like that. But we decided we would make our own bread because by then I was making a lot of bread. And we built the restaurant around the breads that I had kind of developed, including this Struan bread, as well as some other things that both of us like to make, like, you know, like barbecues and chilies and gumbos and soups and salads. And it was a great little homemade little cafe that suddenly became very popular. And by the time we got discovered, a New York Times article came out. Some reporter coming through wrote about us, and suddenly we were kind of national news. And the breads took off. Local other restaurateurs asked if we could make extra bread for them. And before I knew it, I had its bread business on the side of this little cafe business that we had. And so we decided to open a bakery. And eventually the bakery kind of eclipsed the restaurant. And that's when I decided to write a book about it. So it finally came full circle. I finally knew what I was going to write about. And the idea of the first book was called, the bakery was called Brother Juniper's Bakery. So we called it Brother Juniper's Bread Book, Slow Rise as Method and Metaphor. Because what I had, you know, kind of stumbled into was this idea, this notion that bread that rises slowly is better than bread that rises fast. And the whole bill was built around that one little conceit, that one little metaphor that slow is better than fast. And this book came out in 1991. And now I'm about to release at the end of this year my 14th book. So since then, so my writing, you know, I got back on track with my writing. And before you know, a few years later, we're doing Pizza Quest and on the road making videos and films about pizza. And somehow all that early stuff with with filmmaking and broadcasting and writing paid off, and I had something to write about, and this metaphor has been kind of like driving my creative career ever since. Later on, our community actually eventually restructured itself, and we broke into a monastic branch and a householder branch. Those of us who were married, went off and kind of lived independently from each other. And the ones who were monastics, we built monasteries for them. And my wife and I went off and we've been living independently. I dropped the honorific brother a good 20 years ago. And I've just been Peter ever since.
What a journey. On that note, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese has been a pioneer in the specialty food industry for over 20 years. They source the most exceptional, authentic, and creative artisan cheese and accompaniments from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. Every product they carry is thoughtfully hand-selected from their trusted producers in Europe. The standards of Forever Cheese are legendary. Many of their products, including Drunken Goat, Genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Fig and Date Cakes, are now integral to today's market. You can learn more about their product lineup at forevercheese.com. Forever Cheese is proud of their role as a trusted authority in the specialty cheese world. Their philosophy is to put passion behind everything they do, from finding the best products to celebrating those who make them. Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Thanks to Forever Cheese for supporting this episode. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
And we're back. My guest this week is Peter Reinhart, host of the brand new Heritage Radio Network show, Pizza Quest, author, writer, teacher, baker, of course. And Peter, I wanted to ask about some of the upcoming projects that you're working on. You have a symposium coming up. You have a new book in the works. Tell us about the symposium. What's happening and what makes it special?
Well, this has been sort of a passion project of mine now for the last 4 or 5 years. As part of my journey unfolded, I ended up, after we built the bakery, we sold the bakery at that point because I realized that I didn't feel my mission was to run a business. I just didn't enjoy the business side of it. I enjoyed the baking side of it. And I always had a passion for teaching. So I decided to sell and become a teacher, and I ended up getting a great job at the California Culinary Academy as a bread instructor for 5 years, and that led me to a similar position at Johnson & Wales University, which is the largest culinary school in the world, with its first main branches in Providence, Rhode Island. But while we were there, the university announced they were opening a few other campuses, one of which was in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I had done some missionary work during that early seminary period, and I love North Carolina. My wife's family lived in the Carolinas, so we decided to petition to join, be part of the opening staff there. And I got the job, and I came down here, helped open the Charlotte campus of Johnson & Wales, and I've been here for 18 years. As a result, the bread department that we had both in Providence and in Charlotte, we had drawn a number of great bread instructors. And many of them got published. I had, you know, written a number of books. My book, Bread Baker's Apprentice, won, you know, Book of the Year. And some of the other bakers did their own books that were equally great. And I realized we were sitting on basically the most honored and decorated teaching staff of bread making in the United States. And I thought, why don't we just build an event around the fact that we want to really own the bread space and create a venue in which the future of bread could be explored. Because let's face it, bread has been under attack now for quite a number of years. And every couple of years, it has to defend itself again against the low-carb people and the no-carb people and the gluten-free and all this. And yet, despite that fact, bread is still the most beloved of all foods. And so it took me a couple of years to convince the powers that be to kind of give me the green light to do it. But we decided to put together an event that we called the International Symposium on Bread, in which I invited the first year 10 important speakers to come and make presentations all around the question of the future of bread, whether it's in the microbiology side of it, the technology side of it, the history and the art. And we looked at it from all angles. And so the first year was a success. We did it again a second year. Third year, we created a hands-on workshop to actually make products based on the outcomes of the findings that were presented during the first couple of years. And we were scheduled last year to do a fourth one. And, of course, COVID hit, so we had to put it on hold. And during that time, I came up with the idea of and by then, I got, you know, comfortable with the idea of Zoom. And so we thought, let's create a virtual version of the symposium that where we can invite more people and they don't have to get on an airplane and they don't have to get a hotel room and we can all just kind of gather in a virtual space. And so Monday, May 17th, we launch. And we've been putting this together for the last 9 months. And it expanded from being these original 10 speakers. I now have something like 46 presentations scheduled every Monday and every Wednesday for 24 consecutive weeks. we have a presentation, either, you know, a formal presentation, kind of like a TED Talk, that again explores the future of bread from many different angles. And then on Wednesdays, we have more of a demonstration presentation where a very well-known bread baker or craftsperson will come and do a demo showing things that are not the kind of products that necessarily you've seen in demos anywhere else. And so the ticket holders get to go to all those. Their virtual ticket can get them into, you know, any presentation. And if they miss a presentation, we're going to record them. They'll be able to, you know, call them up on demand and watch them anytime till the end of the year. And this, so the symposium starts May 17th, is going to go till October 25th. And, you know, by the, after I put it all together, I went, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? I can't go anywhere now for the next 6 months because I have to host each one of these, gatherings. But on May 17th, we launch. We're going to open with a documentary film made by somebody who had presented a couple of years ago called Bread in the Bones. And it's really a film that celebrates the importance of bread in culture and in just, you know, in life and in our hearts. And it's very nicely done. I'm one of the few people that's actually seen it. And everybody else will get to see it on Monday the 17th. And that's our kickoff. And the following week, we're going to have Apollonia Poilan, the daughter of the most famous bread baker in the world, Lionel Poilan, who was tragically killed 20 years ago. And Apollonia had to take over the bakery while she was just starting her studies at Harvard. And she had to go back and forth over the pond for the next 4 years while she finished her Harvard work and kept the bakery going. She and her sister kept it going. Now, 20 years later, she is, you know, at the helm of the world's most iconic bakery. So she's going to tell us her story and in a sense share what they call the Poilan vision of bread. So we've got lots of people like that. I won't give all the people who are coming because we'll take too long. But if anybody's interested in seeing the whole roster of speakers, all they have to do is go to our homepage, which is one word, breadsymposium.com, breadsymposium.com. And you can see the whole schedule and tickets are cheap there's still time to get in on it. Even after it starts, if you miss the first couple, you can still watch them all because they'll be all recorded. So the best part about it is that when we did the symposiums in Charlotte at my campus, we were limited to 150 tickets because that's how big our auditorium was. Now we have a virtually unlimited capacity, so we can have as many people as possible. So we're looking to have, you know, about 1,000 people attend.
Yeah. Yeah. And how about the new book that you're coming out with?
Well, that book is, yeah, that's another spinoff of Pizza Quest. So, you know, we've gotten the podcast that's about to launch on Heritage Radio, but also because these interviews were so interesting and the people that I met, each one of them, you know, was creating a style or a particular type of pizza that was pretty amazing. I'd have to say they're all doing, you know, work at that memorable level. I came up with an idea of asking them each to contribute one pizza, one, not a recipe, but one of their pizzas to a book that I would write called Pizza Quest, with the subtitle being My Never-Ending Search for the Perfect Pizza Continues, in which I would take their pizza and do a homemaker's version of that, something that anybody could make in their own home oven. Even if they don't have a wood-fired oven, they can make it in a regular oven. And it wouldn't require the pizza makers to divulge any of their particular dough recipes or this or that, because that's what I can do. I can create doughs. I've done a number of pizza books, and I have a number of recipes that can be used for any of these styles of pizza that we're going to feature. And so we end up with 35 pizzas. I'll call them the hero pizzas, or they're going to be the analogy that I used for the pizza guys was that you guys are the Beatles, and I'm the Beatles tribute band. And so I'm going to do a tribute version or a cover version of your pizzas that anyone can make at home. And while it won't be exactly your pizza, it'll be based on your pizza. The photo in the book will be a photo of your pizza. That will be our target. That'll be the beauty shot or the hero. And the goal will be for each person who, you know, who gets the book to be able to attempt to make a pizza that good and that memorable following the basic, you know, easy to follow steps that I'll give them in the book. And so that book is, you know, been now written, and now we're in editing, and I've been told by the publisher that it probably will come out by the end of this year.
Oh, that's exciting. Pretty quick turnaround time for a book.
Yeah, I mean, well,
not maybe, counting the many years that it took.
I'll tell you, it takes a lot of work to get it just from the writing to the actual manifestation. But one thing that's saving us time is that each pizza maker is going to provide their own beauty shot. So they're all taking their own shots or having a photographer take their pizza. So I don't have to recreate 35 pizzas, you know, in a photographer's lab. They will make each. So that's going to save us a lot of time. And I'm gathering those photos now so that if we showcase a pizza from Tony Gemignani, for instance, who's a world champion pizza maker from San Francisco, Tony's also giving us the photo. He gave me the basic ingredients and explained to me what the pizza is supposed to be like. And then I interpreted that, and I'm the house band, you know, so I'm doing the house band version of that pizza.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I wanted to do a little bit of fun rapid fire. So if you're ready.
I will try to be.
How about which bread style do you feel like best represents you and your personality?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier a bread that I developed called Struan. And Struan is a Scottish term that means, it's the name of a clan, but it actually means, from the Gaelic, it means a convergence of streams. It's a harvest bread, and it has about 12 different ingredients in it. And so it weaves together the grains that are harvestable on Michaelmas, which is September 29th. And so unlike a French bread, which is just four basic ingredients, flour, water, salt, and yeast, this harvest bread is really a convergence or a confluence bread of a lot of influences. And so for me, that bread is not only is bread a general metaphor, but that particular bread is the metaphor of me, because I kind of feel like I identify with the fact that my life has taken so many twists and turns and has so many, you know, influences and confluences in it that when you take a bite of that bread, you're taking a bite of my soul.
And a good multigrain bread takes a while to get right. You gotta practice it a few times.
Yeah, but I have to say, the thing that I love about this bread is it makes the best toast. If I were going back into the restaurant business, I would open a toast cafe and I would build it around that particular loaf, and I would make the toast out of that bread. Best toast I've ever had.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. How about a great meal that you had that cost under $5?
Well, it's funny because, you know, there probably are many, but the one that comes to mind immediately, and it probably wouldn't be under $5 now, but when I had it, when I was a kid, the meal that kind of was a benchmark meal for me was when my dad would take me on Saturday afternoon to his favorite hot dog place in Philadelphia called Levis's. Levis's was the Nathan's of Philadelphia. And the hot dogs, when I was a kid, the hot dogs were 25 cents. And then it was a big deal when they changed it to 35 cents. And then I went off to college and came back, and when my dad took me back there, by then the hot dogs had gone up to $2.35 each. And nowadays those hot dogs probably would go for about $8. But, you know, for under a buck, you could get two or three of killer hot dogs, great hot dogs, and with a great mustard and relish and sauerkraut bar, and you could put anything you want on it. That meal, again, since the time I was about 7 years old, is indelibly imprinted in my hall of fame of taste memories.
Yeah. Well, so how come nobody's done an amazing hot dog bun?
That's a good question. Hot dog buns are actually pretty amazing in their own right. As fast and easy as they are, because they're soft and they're sweet. And of course, it's just like a hoagie bun can't be quite that soft. A hot dog bun and burger buns are supposed to be soft. But I think maybe it's because with a hot dog, the star, it really is the hot dog itself, and the bun is the supporting, it's the carrier, it's the vehicle, the delivery system. And so all it has to do is be a really good supporting player. I think if you try to do too much with the bread and try to draw attention from the hot dog, it's not fair to the hot dog, unless it's right. A crappy hot dog, you know, which is, there are some of those out there too.
Got it. I appreciate the distinction. Peter, it's been such a pleasure to talk. Congratulations on your new show and the symposium and the book and everything else. Would you just run through some of those websites again? Where can our listeners find you, purchase your books, and attend the symposium?
Yes. Well, the website itself is one word, breadsymposium.com. And if you, I'm going to give your listeners a discount code. And when you get to if you go through and you decide to get the ticket, and as you're checking out, when you get to the paywall, type in the word Bread Discount, B-R-E-A-D, Bread Discount, one word, all one word, and it will give you a 15% discount. So the tickets are $100 for the whole like 6 month series, but if you, and the VIP tickets, which I think are worth getting, are $125, and that gets you into the after party of every presentation. There's going to be a 45 minute sort of after party with the presenter where people can do a little bit more casual, less formal, you know, interaction. And then you get a 15% discount. So the VIP ticket comes in for, you know, close to, you know, just over $100, and it will get you into everything. But go to the site and it will guide you. There's a little sneak preview of, you know, a video that we made that shows you how the site's going to work. There's a FAQ that tells you, you know, how to interact with it. And I think if you decide to go forward with it, it's going to be an amazing experience.
Yeah. Sounds great. As always, you can reach us, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org, @whyfoodpodcast on social media. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, @burlapandbarrel on Instagram. And you can reach Valerie on Instagram, @foodieinnewyork. Thanks to Armin Spengen, our amazing sound engineer. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song. And most of all, Peter, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing some of your wisdom and experience around bread making.
Well, thank you, Ethan. It's been great being with you.
Likewise. Talk to y'all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.